Well, today's date is April 4th in the Gregorian calendar in the year 2023, and it's 1704 daylight savings, or Eastern Daylight Time, as we call it. Ward Green here with you. The Jewish date today is Nisan 14, and in the Julian calendar, today's date is March 22nd, which is interesting as well, because if we count the number of days from March 22nd, if March 22nd is the first of Nisan, then the 31st, 9 days later, would be the 10th of Nisan. And four more days in April makes it 14. So March 22nd is Nisan 1, in other words. And that's today's date in the Julian calendar. So that's quite a significant and interesting correspondence, wouldn't you say, little children? Anyway, before we begin today, I think we should partake of the emblems today, or pass the emblems and see, before we do anything else, because I think that whatever else we do will not be on the same level as that. So, in memory of Christ's sacrifice, which he did offer on the day of April 5th, was it not? It was April 5th in the year 30 CE, I believe. We looked at that. And on the 4th, after sundown, he ate the evening meal with his apostles. And the 4th of April in the year 30 CE was the Essene, Nisan 14. So, but he died on the same actual day in the Jewish calendar. Let me think now. Let me see. It would be the next day in the Julian calendar, though, April 5th. And April 5th in the evening was when the Sadducees celebrated Passover. So Jesus died prior to that Passover celebration in the afternoon. And we know that because in the Bible we see that they had concern about leaving Jesus' body on the stake on the Sabbath, or the day of Passover, which was a Sabbath of a festival Sabbath. So they didn't want to leave. That would be Wednesday. That would be the Wednesday evening, but beginning the day of Thursday for the Sadducees in the evening on Wednesday night, they didn't want to leave the body on the stake. So that was not yet sundown. In other words, he died when it was not yet sundown. So in memory of his death, Nisan 14, in the Essene calendar, and just prior to Nisan 14 in the Sadducee and Pharisee Jewish calendar, we pass the emblems, which are, in this case, unleavened bread, as usual, with a little salt. And I'm going to do what I believe I should. This year I made rather salty bread. I'm not sure. I don't think I knew that, how salty it was going to be. It's not too bad. And this is the juice of a blood orange. This is the juice of a blood orange. No, this is another example of one of the emblems, the unleavened bread, which I baked in the oven for a few minutes. This is the juice of a blood orange. which I will perhaps drink more completely later on. So now that the matter of the emblems has been taken care of, I'd like to share this song with you, which I heard many years ago, called Day After Day from the album iRobot, again, the Alan Parsons Project, If I Might. That was Day After Day from 1977. The album iRobot, Alan Parsons Project. Gaze at the sky and picture a memory of days in your life. You knew what it meant to be happy and free with time on your side. song that really allows us to reminisce. And by the way, I've heard the new monthly broadcast for April, the JW Broadcasting. And I really enjoyed it a lot, but the song in particular was exceptional in the broadcast for this month. The original song was significant, I thought. So, and there were some other very interesting things also in that broadcast, definitely. The next part of our study for today, the proverb for this study, April 4th, 2023, is Proverbs 27 and 22. Even if you should pound the foolish one fine with a pestle, in a mortar, in among cracked grain, his foolishness will not depart from him. It's a very valuable thing to know about. So this idea that some people sometimes give us about never giving up is something to be taken with a grain of salt, as indicated by this scripture here, that sometimes it's to no avail when we attempt to, or when we are attempting to change other people. We just don't have that ability always to cause other people to do what we want. And nor do we have the ability to teach foolish people wisdom, as this scripture is apparently specifically aimed to point out. So let's look at our article paragraph. Today's reading in the article, Wild Road, Ahead to History, Part 1, Chapter 5, Paragraph 10. This is a very significant paragraph, as many of them, in fact, virtually all of them are, in this article and in all the articles, which Jehovah has allowed us to read or to present and then read afterwards. I read it now, and even though it was written by yours truly, I still don't remember every single detail of all the work I did on this. So, shall we read it then? Here we go. During Israel's time in Egypt, attested primarily from the Bible, lasting from 1914 to 1493 BCE for the whole family of Jacob, also known as Israel, and Israel's descendants, very little is known yet of the history of the period. When the 19 years of King Silites and his descendants in the book of Sothis, or the BOS, are totaled to 274 years, using the 44 years, the greater of the two values for Sertos. Let's look at that in the book of Sothis, right here. Silites, right there. And then Bayon, 44 years. But Silites was 19 years. Bayon, 44 years. Apachnas, 36 years. Apophis, 61 years. And on the next page, we have Sethos, 50 years. Sertos, either 29 or 44. And we've taken the 44, the larger number. And Aseth, 20 years. They're preceding Amos, or Amosis, number 33 there on the list. When we add all those up, excluding Amos, but just up to Amos, beginning with Silites, we arrive at a total of a number which, when we add to it 108 years for Dynasty 15 from the Turin list, we get that Dynasty 15 would be corresponding to the Hyksos, who ruled prior to, but also overlapping the reign of Amos. When we add the 108 to those other years that we just saw, which were 274 if you add them up, using the 44 years for Certos, 108 plus 274, the total of 382 years, right? 100 plus 200 is 300, and 74 plus 8 is 82, so 382, added to 1532, the year of the Hyksos expulsion. Add those two numbers, 382 and 1532. Well, 80 and 30 is 110, and 4 is 114, with the 2 plus 2 there. 114 plus, we also have 114 added to 15 plus 300, or 1800 plus 114, which is 1914. You can do it with a calculator, too, if you want. So we do get the year 1914 when we add those up. The name Silites resembles the Hebrew word referring to Joseph's position as governor. So Silites was the beginning of this number of 382 years here. And we add that to 1532. And we get 1914, which is the beginning of the rule of... It's actually not the beginning of the rule of Joseph. It's the beginning of Israel, Jacob, coming into Egypt, which is interesting. It's not a direct correspondence to Joseph beginning to rule in 1923, but that's okay. It still indicates something about the history of Israel in Egypt, which is the year that Jacob came into Egypt, 1914. But the name Silites resembles the Hebrew word referring to Joseph's position as governor, that word being Shalit, as given explicitly in Genesis 42 and 6. In the Masoretic text, it's the word called H7989, that's the number of the Masoretic Hebrew word that was given to that word in the concordance of, I believe it's from Strong's Concordance that designation is from, but it's known as H7989. But let's look at Genesis 40. Now we have to look at Genesis 42 and 6 for just a moment, just to see that word Shalit, to see the word governor. So Genesis 42 and 6. He was the man in power over the land. He was the man in power over the land. So that's probably where we get the word governor. The word Shalit. Genesis 42 and 6. Yeah, and we don't have the original Hebrew there to look at just yet or just now, but we can perhaps look that up later, some other time. Josephus, now, continuing here, gives the name of this king as Silites, similar form of word. And Manetho, that is, who's the Egyptian historian, Josephus being a Jewish historian who lived sometime after Manetho has it elsewhere as Saites, not having any L in it, always 19 years. He always says 19 years for that king. Interestingly, now, if we continue reading here, the death of Amenemhet II, he was the pharaoh who was ruling at the time that Joseph was appointed second in command of all of Egypt. The death of Amenemhet II is given as 1895 BCE in modern computations. By the modern Egyptologists, which was 19 years after the year 1914. So 1895 BCE, the years count backwards, right? So we have 14 years from 1914 to 1900, counting backwards, and then five more years to 1895, which is a total of 14 plus 5, which is 19 years in total. Thus, the name and time period fit Joseph excellently, because we might imagine that after Amenemhat II died, that marked the end of some important time period for Joseph ruling as second in command of all of Egypt, because he was appointed by Amenemhat II. We are unable to give space to the many corruptions of Manetho which disagree. Manetho has a lot of different numbers, which most of which all disagree with each other for the most part. But we don't worry about all the corruptions of Manetho which don't agree, nor do these corruptions lessen any import that we've gained by studying the ones that did agree. The shepherds are said to leave Egypt and to found the city of Jerusalem. That's something that Manetho says, something which became true later, because we know that Jacob's family were shepherds and they did eventually leave Egypt at the time of Moses, which is quite a bit later in time. It was 1493 BCE when they left Egypt, and then they eventually arrived at Jerusalem after wandering for 40 years in the wilderness. That did come true, and of King Silitus, he is said to have given out rations. Very interesting. King Silitus of Egypt is said to have given out rations, which is something that Joseph did, we know, during the famine, according to the Bible. Joseph gave out rations. Now, in the footnotes, it's interesting that the names Silitis and Shalit are similar to our word silo, meaning a storage facility for grain, which we know that Joseph used to store the grain of Egypt during the plentiful years before the famine came, as recorded at Genesis 41, 49, and 56. Genesis 41, 49, Joseph continued piling up grain in very great quantity. And Joseph, in verse 56, began to open up all the grain depositories. So they have these silos or depositories of some kind. So, that's the end of our study of Moyle Road, except for footnote number one, which refers to the modern computations or the dating of Amenemhat II, which are given as these numbers in footnote one here at the bottom, which we see are 1895 at the end of his reign for at least three of these, and the other two are 1896. Very close to 1895 for all of them. So, today's study in the Bible now. There's a Sphinx of Amenemhat III. Interestingly. Now, today's biblical reading, Genesis 35. So what happened in 34, Dinah was violated, and Simeon and Levi took vengeance upon the house of Shechem because of his actions against Dinah. Now in Genesis 35, after that, God said to Jacob, "Rise, go up to Bethel and dwell there, and make an altar there to the true God who appeared to you when you were running away from Esau, your brother. Then Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, put away the foreign gods that are in the midst of you, and cleanse yourselves and change your mantles. And let us rise and go up to Bethel. And there I shall make an altar to the true God who answered me in the day of my distress, in that he proved to be with me in the way that I have gone. So they gave Jacob all the foreign gods that were in their hands and the earrings that were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the big tree that was close by Shechem. After that they pulled away, and the terror of God came to be upon the cities that were round about them, so that they did not chase after the sons of Jacob. Eventually Jacob came to Luz, which is in the land of Canaan, that is to say Bethel, he and all the people who were with him. Then he built an altar there and began to call the place El Bethel, because there the true God had revealed himself to him at the time of his running away from his brother. El Bethel means the God of Bethel. The word El is, of course, the word for God. Later, Deborah, the nursing woman of Rebekah, died and was buried at the foot of Bethel under a massive tree. Hence, he called its name Elon Bacchus. God now appeared to Jacob once again. Rebekah was the mother, of course, of Jacob and Esau, during his coming from Paddan Aram, and blessed him. And God went on to say to him, your name is Jacob. No longer is your name to be called Jacob, but Israel will your name become. And he began to call his name Israel. And God said further to him, I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and become many. Nations and a congregation of nations will proceed out of you, and kings will come out of your loins. As for the land that I have given to Abraham and to Isaac, to you I shall give it, and to your seed after you I shall give the land. After that, God went up from above him at the place where he had spoken with him. Consequently, Jacob stationed a pillar in the place where he had spoken with him, a pillar of stone, and he poured a drink offering upon it and poured oil upon it. And Jacob continued to call the name of the place where God had spoken with him, Bethel. Then they pulled away from Bethel, and while there was yet a good stretch of land before coming to Ephrath, Rachel proceeded to give birth, and it was going hard with her in making the delivery. But so it was that while she had difficulty in making the delivery, the midwife said to her, do not be afraid, for you will have this son also. And the result was that as her soul was going out because she died, she called his name Benoni, or son of my mourning. But his father called him Benjamin, son of my right hand. Thus, Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is to say Bethlehem. Hence, Jacob stationed a pillar over her grave. This is the pillar of Rachel's grave down to this day. And even to very recent days, we know that there's still the grave of Rachel near Bethlehem in Israel. After that, Israel pulled away and pitched his tent a distance beyond the Tower of Eder. And it came about while Israel was tabernacling in that land that once Reuben went and lay down with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel got to hear of it. So there came to be 12 sons of Jacob, the sons of Leah. The sons by Leah were Jacob's firstborn, Reuben and Simeon and Levi and Judah and Issachar and Zebulun. The sons by Rachel were Joseph and Benjamin. And the sons by Bilhah, Rachel's maidservant, were Dan and Naphtali. And the sons by Zilpah, Leah's maidservant, were Gad and Asher. These are Jacob's sons who were born to him in Paddan Aram. At length Jacob came to Isaac his father, to Mamre, to Kiriath Arba, that is to say Hebron, where Abraham and also Isaac had resided as aliens. And the days of Isaac came to be 180 years. After that, Isaac expired and died, and was gathered to his people, old and satisfied with days, and Esau and Jacob, his sons, buried him. So Isaac lived to be 180 years old. And that's today's study. We see the promise again repeated to Jacob, the promised land, and also the new name of Israel, which was given to Jacob in this chapter, as well as earlier when Jacob wrestled with the angel. So, the promise of the land, but also in verse 11, Jacob was promised that kings would come out of his loins. They would descend in his lineage. That promise was given here, which is quite a promise. And of course, we know that that the king David was a son of Judah. He was a descendant of one of the sons of Jacob, thus. And it was his lineage that produced the line of kings which ruled in Judah. So kings, in fact, did come out of the loins of Jacob. And another example, of course, being Solomon, the son of David, who was a very great king in terms of his wisdom. And the way in which he ruled over his dominion, which was called Israel at that time, before it became divided in the days of his son Rehoboam and became split into the kingdoms of Judah and Israel. But there still were kings that came after Solomon who ruled Judah for many years, in fact. So this is today's study. This is April 4th, Nisan 14, the year 2023. It's before sundown. It's 1737. Hours, Eastern Daylight Time. So I've looked at my new watch. It's a wonderful, beautiful watch. The loom on this watch at night is absolutely stunning. It's some of the best loom that is available to be purchased today in today's world of technology. It's very beautiful. So it's a very good nighttime watch, I would say. And like I said, you know, the fact that there's not a lot of contrast between the hands and the face of this watch, it does have some advantages because it's got gold for the hands, so that even though it's white on the hands, on the center of the hands, it's still gold on the perimeter of the hands, so you can see this. You can read the hands fairly easily. It's got the octopus logo there, right there. Don't know why they don't call it the octopus, but they call it, the company's called Phoebus or Phoebus. It's a Chinese company that uses Japanese movements. In this case, it's a Japanese automatic movement made by Seiko in the inner workings. It's got a beautiful bezel on it, which I may not be using, but it can be used to set a certain time period on it. It's a one-way bezel. Only turns counterclockwise, and you can turn it around to set a certain period from 0 to 60 minutes. It's the possible use is for scuba diving, but you could use it for anything, of course. There's no chronograph on any of my watches other than these, the one right now that I've got currently, which is not being worn. I'm not wearing it today. Yesterday, my watch Dusty, which is this one, has a beautiful dusty texture on the face of it, on the dial of it, I mean. You won't be able to see it, I don't think, unless I can get the light just right here. It's got a grainy texture on the dial. It's called moon dust, and that's why I call it dusty. But this is the most contrast for the hands against the face that I've got on any of my watches. It's very legible, this watch. And this is a Swiss movement, an automatic movement. But I really think this is one of my best, because of its high legibility and the beauty of it and how tough it looks on the outside. All of my watches, except, I shouldn't say all of mine, three of them have a sapphire for the crystal, synthetic sapphire. But my Russian watch has got acrylic, which is, you know, more shatterproof, but more scratchable because it's softer. But the Russian watch, I have to wind my watches because now I realize I have to wind them every day because Liv Dusty, this one, Dusty stopped on me. And I had to reset. And it was gaining about 6 seconds a day. Which is okay. It's okay. If you store your watches in a vertical position with the crown up instead of flat. So if I unlatch my strap here. I love this strap. I love the way it works on my new watch, which is it's a strap that I purchased separately from Juntan. But this watch, if you store it with the crown up, the mechanism runs against gravity, up and down. The balance wheel will turn up, will move around in a circle back and forth, up and down, in a vertical plane. That will slow it down so that it runs slower if you store it this way. So if it runs fast while you're wearing it on your wrist during the day, and also, but of course, if you're standing up during the day, your wrist will be vertical, probably, if you're standing. Most of the time, your wrist will be vertical and it will run slower. But if you're working at a desk, like I am, if I put it on my wrist, make sure I don't pinch myself here, it fits really, really snug on my right wrist. And it fits really well on the left wrist, too. That's why I love this strap so much. It fits both wrists. And even though the watch is fairly heavy, and you need it to fit fairly tight, I can do it on both wrists, which is not always true of every strap. No matter how you do it, it's not always true. But if I put my hand on the desk, it's like this, horizontally. It will run faster because there's no gravity to oppose the movement. So it's running. I believe I have yet to determine. Do I have 01? Oh, yes. Okay. 5. And this is reading about a couple of seconds. Let's see. 15, 13. 2 seconds. That's not much difference. 43. 43, looks like it's coming up to 44, 29, 30. It's not much different. Did I reset this watch? I'm trying to think. Yes, I had to reset my foibos. Why did I reset it? Oh, I know why. I had to reset the foibos today. That's right. And I reset it, and the reason why was because it was set for the date to change at 12 noon instead of 12 midnight. So I had to reset, advance it 12 hours, which is what I did. And then I had to restart the second hand to synchronize it again. So I reset that at 11:40 today, and it's now 17:40 roughly, or 17:44 now. 11 and 17 is 6 hours difference. So it's a quarter of a day it's been running 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. Okay. It's pretty close. 25, 6, 7, 8, 9, 30. 28. It's about 2 seconds, I'd say. 2 seconds fast after a quarter of a day, which would make 8 seconds. Approximately somewhere around 8 seconds, roughly, per day, it's fast, which is still acceptable. Very good. Not like quartz, which are like 0.5 seconds per day, 12 seconds a month for a quartz watch. Much more accurate, but this is a mechanical watch, and it doesn't cause the need for batteries to be replaced. And that's why I like it. And also, it's just a very it's more interesting to me. It's just more interesting. But, I mean, the quartz watches are... I'm very interested in quartz technology because of how accurate it is, too. But I realized that I have a great interest in these mechanical watches. And so I decided to do some purchases. And it's so far been quite interesting. And, you know, I wouldn't say gratifying to a large degree, but moderately gratifying. The thing is, this watch is such an astoundingly good value for what the price is that you pay for it. It could have been a watch that was, you know, I don't want to put a number on it. It could have been easily as expensive as this other Swiss watch. It could have been. Could have been. Because of the quality of the way it was manufactured, but they've kept the price less than half the price of this Swiss watch here. So they're beautiful. Anyway, they're both beautiful. One is Japanese in the inner workings and one is Swiss. And we know Seiko is the main Japanese manufacturer, the one that we think of the most, and in the Swiss manufacturers there are quite a number of them, really a large number, and Rolex is a pretty large contributor to that market with regard to Swiss watches. But the price of the Rolex watches is quite large, quite high, and they're hard to obtain. You have to be put on a waiting list if you want to get a normal retail price, and if you're not able to wait for many, many years to get your Rolex, then you've got to pay much more than retail to get a Rolex. And the price of a Rolex is through the roof. It's sky high right now because of that fact. And of course, there are some good things about Rolex watches. I know that's true. That's why they're so popular. It's one of the reasons. It's a good reason, but they also, just imagine how much it costs to do anything with Rolex, to replace the parts or to get, you know, I'm not sure how much the service costs on the Rolex. Maybe it's not as expensive because of other things, I'm not sure, but because of the design, if they're well designed, the service might not be as much. It can be more expensive to service some watches because they're difficult to service, you know. So that's a factor in deciding which watches to buy. Are they serviceable for a reasonable price is one facet of that. Otherwise, you're just going to put it on the shelf or throw it away after it stops working. So I've tried to buy watches that I thought likely could be serviced in the future. And I don't know how long they're going to last, but I'll try to learn if there are any ways that I can make them last longer before they need service. And I'll try to treat them well. That's really what I've been thinking about. But all these watches need service after 3 to 5 years, that's the thing. And they're, you know, I mean, if it's only a a watch that costs like the Vostok watch, Phoebe, the Amphibia watch. If it's under $200, then after it needs service, it's probably going to cost more than that to service it, so it's probably just worth it to just buy a new watch for that particular watch. If I keep all my watches running, I think that might be better too, because it might keep the lubricants liquid and not letting it might prevent the oils from getting gummed up if you keep your watches running. But on the other hand, not running them might prevent wear and tear, and they might last longer if you don't run them all the time too. So maybe there's some happy medium for allowing watches to run for a long time without needing servicing. But it's a long discussion to talk about watches, though. And not just, I mean, I'm interested in talking about the different features and how people build their own versions of watches. I've just discovered a channel on YouTube where there's many of them, but I've discovered one channel that I enjoy watching with regard to the building of custom watches, where the person buys their own custom parts and puts them together to make their own watch. So it's a fascinating project also. I just love that. I love what I love about watches is the beauty of certain watches, what they have in terms of the aesthetic, the absolute beauty of some watches in terms of their aesthetic design. I love. And this watch, oh my goodness, this watch, the absolute high legibility of that watch is so good. The lume, by the way, on Dusty is not a very good lume, but the lume on this watch at night, fantastic. So, as I said, yeah. So, this one I call Moppy. So, for Word Green, it's Dusty and Moppy saying bye for now.